The conference is now being recorded.
A very good relationship.
I'm just going to have this turn on to the list. Because you have oh, she's, okay.
Okay, we are recording, and now I'm going to mute everyone out, so give me just a second.
Presentation mode is now enabled.
Okay, Alicia, are you still there?
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Great. Okay, so we are recording, and we're all set, ready for you to go.
Okay. Well, I think this is at least the third time in the last 7 years I've been asked to talk to you guys about paternity and parentage. This is really just going to be a slight update of new cases that have come out. I'll go over everything that we've gone over before. You should have an outline. It'll have most, if not all, the full citations of the cases and statutes that I'll be referring to. So if I say something and don't repeat it, don't be concerned. It should be in your outline if you need a citation for later. And not much under the sun has changed regarding parentage and paternity over the last 100+ years. In the cases that have come out have really just affirmed the longstanding situation regarding parentage of children. So with that, Justice Chris Altenburn of the 2nd DCA is kind of one of the big speakers out there on quasi-marital children, and he wrote a law review article a couple of years ago for Florida State. In it, he explains that the word father is a term which refers to numerous situations of functional and legal fatherhood. Some examples are genetic fathers who acted as sperm donors, marital fathers who were married to the mother at the time of the child's conception or birth, biological fathers who were not the mother's husband when the child was conceived or born, and functional fathers who have no legal or biological relationship but provide support and nurturing for the child. Now, paternity is a determination of biological fatherhood, whereas parentage is a determination of the rights and responsibilities of legal fatherhood. Parentage may not be based on biological paternity. Paternity is determined via human leukocyte testing. Parentage is established either by legal presumption or an adjudication in a court proceeding. In Florida, paternity may also be established by voluntary acknowledgement of both parents where it has not already been established by law. You can refer generally to Chapter 742 of the Florida statute. Neither a scientific determination of biological paternity nor a legal finding of fact as to biological paternity will establish parentage, legal fatherhood, in and of themselves. And there's a list of cases in your outline on page 1 that you can read for that proposition. I gave you a list of statutes on page 1, and I'm going to talk to you about what those say. So a woman who gives birth to a child is a parent. She is also the natural guardian of the child, entitled to primary care and custody, absent a court order to the contrary, if she was unmarried at the time of conception and birth of the child. A woman or a man who adopts a child are parents. Furthermore, Florida statutes require the mother's husband to be listed on the child's birth certificate as a father unless paternity has been established otherwise in a court of law before the child's birth. An unmarried biological father who's properly executed a written acknowledgement, filed his acknowledgement with the Office of Biostatistics, and otherwise complied with Section 63.062 of the Florida statute, which includes demonstrating a full commitment to his parental obligations, showing financial support of the child or the mother's pregnancy, and the development of a substantial relationship where the child is more than 6 months old. He must be noticed in any pending action for adoption of the minor child and in a dependency proceeding, and as a person whose consent is required for adoption. A prospective parent is a person who claims to be or has been identified as a person who may be the mother or father of the child. A prospective parent is not a parent in a dependency case. Florida law further unequivocally rejects the notion of dual fathership. There is only one man who can be vested a parental right to one particular child at any one moment in time. Now, under the common law, common law has been codified, so let's first talk about those. Parentage of a child born to a marriage or of children born to a mother and reputed father who married is established by the presumption of legitimacy. You can also see that in Statute 382.013, subsection 2, subparagraph A, which provides the husband is the presumed father and the legal father, and his name is required to be recorded as the father of the child on the birth certificate within 5 days of the birth, unless there is a court order providing otherwise. You can also see that in Chapter 742.091, which states there that if the mother and reputed father of a child born out of wedlock marry at any time after the birth of the child shall be deemed and held out as a child of the marriage. The presumption of legitimacy is a common law presumption that a child born to marriage is a child of the marriage, and the husband is the father of the child. It establishes legal fatherhood in the husband of the mother to the exclusion of all others. Eldridge was a big case on point with that, and that's from 1944. The presumption of legitimacy is a presumption that historically was almost impossible to defeat. The presumption is based on the public policy of protecting the child and advancing the child's best interests. It has been found to be undefeatable even over the claims of men proven beyond all doubt to be the biological father, time and time again, in state courts of appeal, federal district courts, and the United States Supreme Court. And I provide you with a long list of cases that all stand for that proposition. Florida common law is noted to detest any action attacking a child's legitimacy. You can review GFC for a full explanation of that. Under the common law, only a husband could bring an action to impugn a child's legitimacy, and then his burden was to prove he was impotent, or he did not have access to his wife during the time of conception. And to make it even more difficult, the husband and the wife were not permitted to testify regarding the husband's access to his wife. In the case of Johnson v. Ruby, the Fourth District continued the common law tradition of protecting the child by holding that when a child is born to an intact marriage, a putative father has no cause of action. Under the common law, no cause of action exists to compel a determination of paternity or establish parentage. Paternity proceedings are purely statutory. There is no common law right to a determination of paternity. The paternity statutes, which modify common law, must be strictly construed. They do not contemplate a determination of legal or equitable issues in a paternity action disconnected from the determination of paternity pursuant to those statutes, except for the allowance of support, child care expenses, visitation, and custody, incidental to that primary cause of action. We're up to page 3 on your outline. So Florida enacted Chapter 742, which provides authority for the establishment of parentage. Under that chapter, where parentage has not been established by law or otherwise, the following three persons are authorized to file a cause of action to establish parentage: a woman who has a child or who is pregnant, a man who believes he is the father of the child and the child. Section 742.10 vests the trial court with primary jurisdiction to provide procedures for determining paternity for children not born to a marriage. Chapter 742 also declares paternity is established for the purposes of this chapter via uncontested voluntary acknowledgement, executed in accordance with sections 382.013 and 382.016. Those are the vital statistics portions of the statute, which refer to the birth certificate. The acknowledgement must be executed by both the mother and the individual to be named as the father under oath, and they must provide their social security numbers in the acknowledgement. The acknowledgement must also be signed by two witnesses and notarized. Valid execution creates a rebuttable presumption of paternity and can only be rescinded within 60 days from the date of signing unless there is a judicial or administrative order on paternity entered within the 60 days deciding the matter of paternity. It specifically provides, if the mother is not married at the time of the birth, the name of the father may not be entered on the birth certificate without the execution of an affidavit signed by both the mother and the person to be named as the father. The facility shall give notice orally or through the use of video or audio equipment and in writing of the alternative to, the legal consequences of, and the rights and responsibilities that arise from signing an acknowledgement of paternity, as well as information provided by the Title 40 agency established pursuant to Chapter 409 regarding the benefits of voluntary establishment of paternity. Upon request of the mother and the person named as the father, the facility shall assist in the execution of the affidavit, a notarized voluntary acknowledgement of paternity, voluntary acknowledgement of paternity that is witnessed by two individuals and, pay close attention, signed under penalty of perjury. Without a doubt, when a mother and a man to be named on the birth certificate execute their signed witnessed affidavit attesting to paternity under oath, and they are attesting to biological fatherhood, this establishment of paternity is done after full disclosure of the legal consequences and alternatives and under penalty of perjury. Be aware that 742.108 provides penalties for false statements of paternity. Therefore, where a child is born to a married woman and the child's birth certificate indicates anyone other than the husband is the father, the birth certificate is void because it is obtained fraudulently. And you do have a case in your outline to support that. Additionally, Chapter 742 vests the Department of Revenue with authority to file administrative proceedings for paternity under Section 409.256 due to the state's compelling interest in children living free of poverty and public welfare. In the administrative and judicial proceedings authorized in Chapter 742, evidence of biological paternity may be sought and admitted into evidence. Section 409.256 goes on to provide authority to compel participation in paternity testing, sanctions for failing to submit to paternity testing, and procedures for contesting the order to submit to testing and to challenge the results of any such testing. So the due process rights of the alleged biological parent are protected through all of those procedures. And they are able to get a default if an alleged biological father is served with notice and fails to appear for the genetic testing and does not otherwise show up in court to contest it. Now, the Florida Supreme Court case of Department of Health and Rehabilitative Services versus Prevett is one of the well-known cases, and it provides guidance on the complex issue of paternity and the preservation of legitimacy. In Prevett, the Florida Supreme Court found the state's authority to establish paternity in an action to establish child support does not outweigh the future interests of the subject child or the sanctity of legally established family relationships. At the time Prevett was litigated, the Department of Health and Rehabilitative Services, or DHRS, was charged with recouping state monies expended on behalf of children benefiting from TANF cash assistance or Title 40 funds. In Corvette, the DHRS filed an action to establish paternity after having the mother execute a templated affidavit and complaint stating that she was not married at the time of birth and conception. That, in fact, later turned out to be untrue. Since 2002, when Corvette was litigated, Section 409.2561 has been amended and Section 409.256 has been enacted. Further, the Department of Revenue has taken the place of DHRS. Corvette held the child's best interest as the primary issue in such a proceeding, and the state's interest in establishing paternity does not become compelling until it establishes an adequate factual basis and shows the child's best interest will be served by paternity testing. It created a test providing for the transfer of legal fatherhood from the marital father to the biological father. It created a test prohibiting the transfer of the legal fatherhood from the marital father to the biological father, absent a showing by clear and convincing evidence that the child's best interest would be better served by being declared illegitimate and having the parental right transferred to the biological father. There must be a clear and compelling reason based primarily on the child's best interest to overcome the presumption of legitimacy even after the legal father is proven not to be the biological father. This is at least the equivalent of the burden of proof that would exist in proceeding to terminate the legal father's parental rights. Now, common law and Florida statutes provide for the disestablishment of paternity. It's clear in Florida law that a child does not have two fathers, and it's against public policy to prevent a presumption of legitimacy unless it's in the child's best interest. Corvette, and there's a newer case, G versus JR, which is a Second District Court of Appeal case from this year, explain that. If a favorable rebuttable is possible, the Fifth District Court, in the case of GFC, has suggested a putative father who's trying to attack his biological child's legitimacy and assume her legal father's parental rights might file a petition to establish paternity pursuant to the Florida State Constitution's due process clause. In such a claim, the prospective father, as the petitioner, has the burden of proving the legal father has abused, abandoned, or neglected the child, and the child's manifest best interest will be better served by severing the legal father's parental rights and establishing those rights in the prospective father. The burden of proof is by clear and convincing evidence. A guardian ad litem must be appointed to represent the child, and the legal father is an indispensable party. This action must be brought prior to the termination of the legal father's parental rights. The case of Shuler v. Guardian ad litem program stands for the proposition that once parental rights of the legal father are terminated, the biological father does not have any shoes to step into. In GFC, a putative father filed an action for paternity under Chapter 742, where the child was born while the husband and mother were living together. The Fifth District held that the putative father had no cause of action under common law, under the Florida statute, under the Florida Constitution, nor under the United States Constitution. It held that there was no cause of action under Chapter 742 for a man to petition to establish his paternity to a child born to an intact marriage between the mother and another man because Section 742.011 only provides a cause of action to establish paternity where paternity has not been established by law or otherwise. Paternity is established when a child is born to an intact marriage and the husband and wife recognize the child as theirs. The husband is the legal father of the child to the exclusion of all others. Furthermore, the court in GFC again affirmed a scientific determination that a man other than the legal father is the child's biological father is irrelevant. So just to explain GCF a little bit better, while the alleged biological father who was petitioning in GFC did not prevail, the Fifth District Court of Appeal reaffirmed all the prior findings regarding the presumption of legitimacy and that an alleged biological father does not have a case However, they left out there a suggestion that a certain type of alleged biological father, where he could prove the child was abused, abandoned, or neglected, it's in the child's best interest, and the other factors that I discussed, might have a claim. The 5th CCA did later take up the case of Fernandez v. Fernandez, and in that case, the court did find that that alleged biological father who was moving to establish his paternity did meet those factors. Fernandez is the only case of its kind. Now, a trial court who is hearing a petition by a biological father must afford the alleged biological a hearing on standing. However, so long as the husband and wife are married and they have no pending action for dissolution of marriage, trial courts are not authorized to engage in any qualitative analysis of whether the marriage is intact. Now, I'm going to step away from your outline for just a minute. Be aware that there's an outlier case called Lander v. Smith. It's not new. It's from 2005. The citation is 906 Southern 2nd, 1138. That's Lander v. Smith, 906 Southern 2nd, 1138. In Lander, the Fourth reached the opposite finding, where they found a case by an alleged biological father could proceed where a mother put a biological father on the birth certificate instead of her husband. The child was conceived during a marital separation, and the alleged biological father had a relationship with the child. The Fourth found the case could proceed where common sense and reason were outraged by rigidly applying the presumption of legitimacy. However, 2 years later, writing the Fourth CCA, writing the case of Lohman v. Carnahan, that's Lohman v. Carnahan, 963 Southern 2nd, 985. That's 963 Southern 2nd, 985. A child born to a marriage where the husband and wife decide to raise the child as a child of their marriage, that any man who may have contributed his DNA had no statutory or constitutional right to intrude on that. They limited Lander to its very specific facts. So Lander's kind of hanging out there. The Second District Court of Appeal in RHB certified the question to the Florida Supreme Court, certified the conflict, actually. The conflict wasn't resolved. Lander just kind of hangs out there. But the Fourth CCA did step back from it and hold it to its very specific facts in the Lohman decision. Pravette is also kind of one of those that goes out on its own. Be aware of the Florida Supreme Court. There's been two cases, Gammon v. Cobb, 335 Southern 2nd, 261. It's a case from 1976. The second VCA writing in the RHB versus JBW decision kind of, you know, went back and explained Gammon and Pravette, and found that, explained that how in 1976 the Florida Supreme Court had found Chapter 742 unconstitutional, where it had said unmarried woman. It removed that, and now it just says any woman. So it stood for the proposition that a child of a married woman has equal protection rights for the mother to pursue a claim against an alleged biological father. Then Pervette came back 17 years later and explained it a little more without specifically citing the Gammon v. Cobb, that right is highly restricted by the child's right to legitimacy and stability. The notable issues in Gammon and Pervette was that the legal father of the children had been gone for many, many, many years, and there was an issue of poverty for these children. So they kind of carved that out, allowing the mother or the state to go after the biological father where there was no legal father supporting the child. You can also read Callahan versus Department of Revenue, which is 800 Southern 2nd 679, which discusses that just like RHC does. In fact, Callahan goes on to explain, getting back to the outline, that there's another line of cases, Daniel v. Daniel, Leffler v. Leffler, Gant v. Gant, that allows a legal father who doubts the paternity of a child born in a marital relationship to establish that he's not the biological father of the child and thereby escape child support obligations or responsibilities to the child. The Fifth District Court of Appeal had a hard time reconciling that line of cases with Prevett, but they found that the key uniting factor was that the legal father initiated the cause of action and that there was a social policy that he had the right not to be burdened with a child who is not his, and that that may trump the child's best interest. This establishment is now codified in Florida law as Section 742.18. Section 742.18 allows a limited cause of action by a legal father to disestablish paternity. Such a petition must be filed in the court that has jurisdiction over the child support obligation. If the support obligation was established in administrative proceedings, then it must be filed in the circuit court in the county where the mother resides and served on her and the Department of Revenue. The petition must include an affidavit by the petitioner, who is the legal father, that newly discovered evidence relating to the child has come to the petitioner's knowledge since the initial paternity determination. And that's really the crux of it, is that there is newly discovered evidence relating to paternity. The second factor is the result of the paternity test administered within 90 days prior to the filing of the petition excludes the legal father as the biological father, or an affidavit stating that the legal father did not have access to the child to have the scientific testing performed prior to filing his petition. And three, an affidavit executed by the petitioner stating the petitioner is current on all child support payments or has just cause for any delinquent payments. Now, to grant a petition to disestablish, a court must find all of the following. One, as I said before, that there's newly discovered evidence relating to the paternity of the child since the initial paternity determination or establishment of child support. Two, scientific paternity testing was properly conducted. Three, the legal father is current on the child support payments or has just cause for delinquency of any support payments. Four, the petitioner did not become the legal father by adoption. Five, the petitioner did not act to prevent the biological father from asserting parental rights in the child. Six, the child was not conceived during the marriage of the legal father and mother through artificial insemination. And seven, the child is under 18 years of age at the time of the filing of the petition. However, the court shall not set aside paternity where the legal father engaged in any of the following conduct after he learned he was not the biological father of the child. One, married the mother as the reputed father of the child and voluntarily assumed parental obligations and financial support. Two, executed a sworn voluntary acknowledgement of paternity. Three, consented to being named on the birth certificate. Four, offered a written voluntary promise of support, which became the basis of the obligation for child support. Five, disregarded written notice from a state agency or court directing him to submit to scientific paternity testing. Or six, signed a voluntary acknowledgement of paternity as provided for in Section 742.10 sub 4. We're on page 6 of your outline if you're just joining us. So under Chapter 742, like in Daniel, the rendition of an order setting aside paternity does not affect the legitimacy of a child born during a lawful marriage. The First District Court of Appeal explained in State Department of Revenue versus Travis that in a hearing to establish child support, it was error to order scientific paternity testing for a legal father who had voluntarily acknowledged paternity in an affidavit. The First District found the legal father had not pursued either of his two available remedies. Where he signed a voluntary acknowledgement, a petition to disestablish under 742.18 is not available. He needs to file to show that the voluntary acknowledgement has been obtained by fraud or duress under 742.10. Now, parentage and dependency proceedings. So the purposes of Chapter 39 proceedings are the protection, safety, and care of children, and second, the strengthening support of the family. Chapter 39 does not state a purpose for establishing paternity, but it is concerned with paternity or with parentage to afford notice and opportunity to participate to those so entitled. Neither the court in its own motion nor any party in Chapter 39 proceedings has a statutory basis on which to motion for scientific paternity testing. Moreover, Chapter 39 doesn't contain the due process mechanisms of 742, which authorizes scientific testing to determine paternity and the methods to go about service, default, and for an alleged biological parent to contest having to submit to the testing or to contest the results of such testing. Now, Chapter 39 has narrow statutory authority for the determination of paternity of children. It's limited to uncontested paternity determinations of children born out of wedlock. Section 39.503 sub 8, you'll find the same provision in 39.803, allows the prospective parent to be considered a parent for the purposes of a dependency proceeding so long as the other parent does not contest the putative parent's recognition as a parent in a dependency case. So the alleged parent comes in, their oath or signs a voluntary acknowledgement. If the other parent agrees or does not object, and yes, they need to be there or be brought in later, then the alleged biological parent can be established as the father of the child in a dependency case. That's where there is no paternity established otherwise. If the other parent objects under Chapter 39, then the alleged biological parent has to file a proceeding under 742 to establish paternity. That biological parent continues to receive notice in the dependency proceedings until the 742 proceeding has reached a final judgment. Now, the juvenile rules were amended at the end of 2013. The dependency court is now permitted to conduct the Chapter 742 proceeding to determine parentage. Again, you have to follow, the dependency court has to follow the 742 requirements. There aren't shortcuts that you do because we're typically under Chapter 39. It can be done by the same judge in the same court, but we are applying Chapter 742. In a proceeding on termination of parental rights under Chapter 39, a prospective parent has until the adjudicatory hearing on the petition to execute the sworn affidavit of parenthood acknowledging paternity and to become a parent for the purposes of the termination of parental rights proceeding. Be aware of the case of ND versus Department of Children and Family Services. It's found that the trial court independency doesn't have the right to determine a disputed issue of paternity. Again, now juvenile rules have been amended, which allows the court to conduct the 742 proceeding. but it also found that the parent has a right to a jury trial. An identified prospective parent is at most a participant in the dependency proceedings. They are not a party. Participants are entitled to receive notice, but not to intervene. A prospective father does not have any parental rights in the proceeding until the court establishes or recognizes those rights. Furthermore, Section 39.503 and 39.803 provide special procedures for identifying prospective parents or prospective parents entitled to notice of proceedings when a parent's identity or location is unknown. All those procedures are now laid out in the juvenile rules. The purpose of the Chapter 39 inquiry on parentage is to give notice. It does not vest any individual with party rights nor parental rights. And I refer you to the case of Shuler, where neither the paternity testing showing that Shuler was the biological father of TS nor the legal finding in the dependency case that Shuler was the biological father gained Shuler legal fatherhood. The legal fatherhood of the child TS lied with the mother's husband up to and through the termination of the legal father's parental rights and the mother's. In Shuler, the mother and the biological father were actually living together when the child was taken into custody. The child was living with them. However, the mother was still married to another man at the time, which made him the legal father. The trial court terminated the legal father's rights based on a failure to appear. The trial court did not allow the biological father to intervene in the termination because he was not the legal father. The biological father filed the action after the termination order was rendered. The trial court scheduled a prevent hearing and ordered Shuler to undergo a DNA test. The DNA test, in fact, confirmed that he was the biological father of TS. The trial court dismissed Shuler's paternity action and placed the child with the department for purposes of adoption. Under 39.812, when the court grants a petition for termination, its disposition powers are limited to those that are available in 39.812. And where the child is in foster care, the child is to be placed with the department for the purposes of adoption. The Fifth District held that the mother's husband was the legal father of the child until such time as the court had effected a substitution. Because Shuler waited until after the rendition of the termination order, he did not properly preserve his parental interest. Now, even if a putative father filed a sworn affidavit of paternity under Sections 39.503 or 39.803, such an action, even with the consent of the mother, is an insufficient basis for the trial court to adjudicate paternity and dependency action where paternity has already been established by law. It's just an affidavit. It doesn't meet the rigors of terminating the legal father's parental rights. Where paternity is established by law, the trial court has no basis on which to grant a motion to intervene or adjudicate a putative father as the legal father. Rule 8.226, which I explained earlier, the amendment to the juvenile rules, now states that the court shall not recognize an alleged biological parent as a parent unless the court has entered a lawful order establishing the alleged biological parent as a parent. The court further must have personal jurisdiction over the prospective parent to proceed with 742 proceedings. And I've referred you to the case of EK versus the Department of Children and Families. In that case, the long-arm jurisdiction of the state of Florida did not reach the alleged biological father. He had never lived in the state, he did not visit the state, and he did not have sexual intercourse with a mother in the state of Florida. Therefore, Florida did not have personal jurisdiction over him, even though Florida did have jurisdiction over the dependency matter and to protect the child and to adjudicate the child. So, to sum up, The dependency court has full authority to make a putative father a parent in a dependency case where paternity has not otherwise been established by law upon the putative father's execution of a sworn affidavit of parenthood and where the mother does not contest his recognition as a parent and to conduct proceedings under Chapter 742. I should point out that the chapter, in Chapter 39, it mentions the mother objecting. The juvenile rule, 8.226, mentions any party objecting. So be aware of that slight difference. A putative father of a marital child may file an action to establish paternity pursuant to the state constitution's due process clause if he seeks to effect a substitution of the legal father to parental rights, and the court must afford him a hearing on standing. That's under GFC. Again, Fernandez is the only case where this has actually happened and been successful in, as far as the appellate decisions are concerned. In such an action, a guardian ad litem must be appointed, and a legal father is an indispensable party. A legal father of a marital child seeking to disestablish paternity must file a Section 742.18 petition to disestablish paternity and meet all requirements to prevail on such a petition. A legal father, due to voluntary acknowledgement seeking to establish paternity, has a remedy under 742.10.4 if he can show fraud or duress in the execution of the affidavit. And that's our parentage discussion. If Mary Kay wants to unmute the line, we can see if there's any questions. I know I talk quickly.
Presentation mode is now disabled.
I think the line's open. Does anyone have any questions?
Alicia, this is Free out of the Fifth Circuit.
Hi.
Hi, I have a question. Recently we had a case where we have a birth certificate father who is not participating in our case, but he is named as the father on a birth certificate. Him and the mother were never married, and he hasn't participated, and now the mother has named a prospective biological father that lives in another state. And the department is considering seeking DNA on that person. And my question is, and I have researched this a little, is whether or not the birth certificate father is entitled to notice of the DNA testing.
I would say absolutely. There are a couple of new cases out there where, hang on, I have on my stack here. I think it was, take a look at Tina v. Diaz, and there's some related cases to that as well. Because, you know, the statutes, you know, are really, really clear that the mother and the man who's going to go on the birth certificate are completely educated, and they swear that he's a biological parent under penalty of perjury, that they can't then, you know, they have the 60 days to have the affidavit set aside. If they don't come back within the 60 days, they're probably not going to get released from the circuit court. In the Pena case, it was really clear. It was total fraud. The mother and, hang on, just making sure it is Pena. No, it's not. I will find the case, though. There is a case that said where the mother and the man named on the birth certificate, they executed a contract saying that she was going to put him on the birth certificate. It was purely to get around the adoption statutes. They came to court and told the court that. When the child was 2 days old, went to live with the man who was still on the birth certificate and his wife. And then a couple years later, the mother filed to set aside the paternity to bring in the alleged biological father, and he had never been involved. The court said absolutely not. In that case, the first attempted father was raising the child and had a relationship, so I'm sure that went into the court's decision. But I think that case is directly on point with what you're dealing with, and you're going to have to address those issues before DNA testing is ordered. Plus, on top of that, keep in mind, it has to be done through 742. So you also have the issue that if this guy is out of state, does the long arm person reach him?
Thank you, Alicia. If you don't mind sending that site when you locate it, I'd greatly appreciate it.
I will find it and send it out.
Thank you.
Can you send me an email so I can respond to it?
Hi, Alicia. This is Ann from the 7th. Can you hear me?
Hi, Ann. How are you?
I have a question about once the TPR order is signed, if the mother never had named a father, the father is unknown, she could never come up with a name, and then after the TPR order is signed, a little while later, she then comes up with a bio father and his DNA is positive. Is there any way for him to establish his rights after the TPR order is signed?
That would fall directly under Shuler, in my opinion, which says okay. No.
I mean, I didn't think so, but you went through that so fast, I just wanted to make sure I heard you right.
Although Shuler is a case of a marital child, is this a marital or a non-marital child?
Non-marital. She was like 14,
okay.
And she named one young boy that his DNA was negative, and she never provided another name until just recently.
Typically, no, because of the finality of orders, so long as you followed all the proper procedures. You did the diligent search. You did the proper inquiry. Check the putative father registry. If everything was procedurally done correctly.
It appears that it was, yes. So I think his only option would be adoption or permanent guardianship.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay, thank you.
Anybody else?
No, it was just very confusing for me not to answer every time someone said Alicia.
Hi, Alicia.
Hey, Alicia. I was like, they're not talking to you. You don't know what you're talking about anyway. So just shut up. They're not talking to you. I do.
No problem. All right. Well, thank you, everybody. Have a good afternoon.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks, Alicia.
Thank you.